Everybody, welcome back to One Club Shorts Podcast. We are 5 days away from our last event of the year at Morris County Golf Club. It's an awesome golf course. It's fall ball here in the Northeast, and we are super excited to end at this golf course. We've said this before, and I probably sound a little bit like a broken record, but we are super excited to end at this place because it's just going to be so much fun. I talked to the one of the assistant pros today, and the GM. Course is looking phenomenal. It is just a great time of the year. It's 70 degrees up here. The weather looks like it's going to be absolutely perfect. The food's going to be great. Golf is going to be great. Drinks are going to be flowing. We've got some awesome tee gifts that we're ready to hand out as soon as you register to this thing. Great prizes along the way. So it is just such a fun way to end our season. We got a couple spots open. If anyone's listening and wants to join in, please go to oneclubshort.com and register. Don't be shy. We love to meet you all and end your golf season on a high note, because we know we're looking forward to ending ours on a high note. With that said, there's a lot to talk about this week. It is Ryder Cup week. It is the good guys versus the bad guys. The Solheim Cup ended in kind of a wishy-washy tie, but not in favor for the U.S. because we needed an absolute win to walk away with the trophy there. So we'll talk about that. Ton of stories going on with the Ryder Cup itself. We're going to talk about the course. We're going to talk about the teams, the players, all the ins and outs of what could happen, what we think is going to happen, where the betting lines are, where the where we think the what the advantages are going to be for the Europeans being home on their turf. We're going to talk a little bit about college football. We're going to talk a little bit about Will's psyche right now after that big, big game against Ohio State and Notre Dame.
You're going to hate my take on this. You're going to absolutely hate it.
Yeah, because I'm sure he's going to be counting it as a win somehow. And then we'll do a little bit of quick math and see how many people we need on the field for a goal line stance. We'll talk about that later. And then we'll talk about we'll finish off with some NFL talk, which obviously ends well for any of us here, except for Glenn right now, being a Bills fan. Will, let's get started. I guess let's start with the Ryder Cup, right? I mean,
yeah, man.
Biggest topic in the world right now.
Yeah. So it's Ryder Cup week, one of the most unique and exciting events in golf. And I want to start off with one stat that I found interesting, because it's supposed to be one of the most exciting events in golf, but recently it really hasn't been. Going back to 2004, beginning with the Ryder Cup where the U.S. got housed at Oakland Hills, only two Ryder Cups have been decided by fewer than 5 points. Typically, they've just been blowouts, and more recently, it's been that the home team blows out the away team. But this event in the last two decades does not have a tendency to be close. Glenn, I'll start with you. The last Ryder Cup was a historic blowout. The U.S. won 19-9. The Europeans never really had a chance. I think for a lot of the intervening 2 years here, there's been the thought that, you know what? Like, this U.S. team is a wagon. They're just going to do it again. Going into this week, I'm certainly not feeling that way. Are we getting our first competitive Ryder Cup in 11 years this week?
You know, that's a good question. You never know with this thing. I mean, on paper, yes, it should be, right? Teams are pretty evenly stacked. Wisconsin was just a bloodbath. The U.S. was just so much better. But I do think we're going to get a competitive one, and I really hope so, because when you look at these teams and the coaches, with the lack of some of the biggest characters in golf, there's not a lot of personality on that golf course this weekend. So we're going to have to hope for good golf to bring viewers in.
Absolutely. Craig, just talk to me about, before we get into odds, players, pairings, matchups, any of that, talk to me about starting with, Sunday at Whistling Straits and ending with 2 days before this coming Ryder Cup. How have your opinions and thoughts changed about is this an empire for the U.S.? Are we back to contention? Is this U.S. team an underdog because they're going over the pond? How have your thoughts about this evolved over the last 2 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think I said it before a while ago, but I stand by it. If you asked me at the end of the last Ryder Cup, I would have said U.S. is going to go on a roll for the next, you know, four Ryder Cups. That team just looks so good that I would have thought that that team would have been so hard to beat because they were young, they were hungry, they just were gelling, they just were having a great time. And then LIV happened. And then, yeah, you know, there was that little bit of a divide. And, you know, we lost some players along the way as far as, you know, the DJs of the world, the Brysons of the world, even the Brooks of the world were, you know, they just kind of, I know he's playing on this team, but they weren't as unified as they once were. I think it actually, looking at it now, I think LIV actually benefits Europe a lot more than it benefited the U.S. team, because I think the European team needed a kick in the butt and needed a fresh start and some new faces in there to kind of shake it up a little bit. That old guard was so good for so long and, you know, was just so good in the competition, but needed a fresh start. And it just showed at the last Ryder Cup. The U.S., I think, really, you know, I don't know. I feel like they are going to – they're going to take a step back a little bit. I think not having the DJs and the Brysons of the world are going to definitely affect them. You know, they're really underdogs, where I thought going into this last year, coming out of the last event, they were definitely going to be the front runners, regardless of where the home turf was. So I still think they have a really good shot of pulling this off, even though it's on foreign soil. I'm not counting them out by any means, but it's not going to be the runaway that I thought it was going to be, you know, a couple of years ago. So yeah, it's just going to be interesting. I actually think there's a lot more storylines than what people are making it out to be, but I do think LIV benefited the European team more than it did the U.S. team.
And that's so interesting, right? Because so many of the guys who left for LIV from Europe were the Ryder Cup stalwarts, right?
Yep.
I mean, you think about the guys who have really tormented the U.S. in Ryder Cups. A lot of those guys are not playing on this European team. And you have to wonder, like, how does this affect them? Obviously, Tommy Fleetwood may have become that guy in Paris, and who knows if he still is. But looking over to that other side and not seeing Sergio and not seeing Poulter and not seeing, you know, Lee Westwood and whoever else, like, between that group going to LIV and kind of ceding their spots to the next generation as well, it at least means it's going to take new faces to beat the U.S. It's not going to be the same story. And Glenn, should I be optimistic about that? Or at this point, it's 30 years of Ryder Cups in Europe. It doesn't matter who's on the team. We know how these things go.
It always matters. I think the LIV effect is that the Europeans lost personality and fire, and the United States lost talent. You know, they don't have Sergio. They don't have Ian Poulter. They don't have those guys that get under the U.S. player's skin, and we don't have talents like DJ and Bryson and even Patrick Reed, who also gets under skin.
Yeah.
It's almost like this Ryder Cup is like bros versus nice guy. You got the bros, you got Speed Thomas and Fowler, and then the nice guys, you got Hovland and Rahm and Fleetwood, and everybody likes these guys. So I think, you know, I think it's going to be pretty evenly matched. I'm going to be looking for the personality of this, the soul of each team. You know, I'm looking at the European team and thinking, Tyrrell Hatton, he's pretty outspoken. He's not afraid to say what he wants. When he wants, Shane Lowry's the same way. I don't see anybody on our side. I mean, Spieth has fire. His game's a little bit questionable, but we shall see when we get over there to Italy when it starts in 2 days. But yeah, it's going to be interesting. Like this is the hardest one to call. And like, I'm not used to going into Ryder Cup going, oh, I can't wait to crush Sergio and Ian Poulter. Come on, guys, get him. I don't know. I'm like, go get Tommy. Well, no, I like Tommy Fleetwood.
Yeah, this is the most likable two teams you could possibly go against each other. It's a tough one. But I do think the fire is going to come out at a certain point. Like, you know, Rahm, Rory, even Hovland, you know, Fleetwood, they're going to get their, you know, they're going to get their fur up at some point, right? None of these guys are going to want to lose, especially when, you know, the playing for your country is just a different animal. I think when the time is right, these guys are going to really start to, you know, push the envelope you're going to see a lot more fist pumping than you normally do. You're going to see a lot more hooting and hollering than you normally do. I think these guys are going to make it exciting, a lot more exciting than you would see in any other normal event that they play in. So I think it's going to be fine. I think it's going to be great. It's going to be hard to root against any of them, except for the fact that the flags, you know, not your country's flag. So, it was really easy to root against Europe in years past. It just is going to be a little bit harder this time around.
Yeah, I think there's even a live effect on the fire. The teams aren't sniping at each other at all, and they're just kind of sniping at Liv. The Liv players who aren't. So it's kind of interesting. It's like, hey, guys, I know Liv is this cloud that hangs over all of golf, at least for the next year, but let's get at this Ryder Cup thing. Let's start some chalkboard quotes up there to get the other team fired up. Let's start talking about each other and stop taking swipes at Liv.
So we know it's the most likable European team in a while, and Liv is probably the uniting factor there. But let's talk about the quality of this European team. And Glenn, I know you said it always matters who's on the team, but I feel like the Ryder Cup has proven that wrong enough times for me to doubt it. So if we believe the rankings that were published in The Athletic by Brendan Quinn, Brody Miller, and some others, Europe has the three best players in this Ryder Cup, Rory, Hovland, and Rahm, and the three worst players in this Ryder Cup, which they had as Straka, Robert McIntyre, and Nicolai Højgaard. Datagolf tells a little bit of a different story. They think that Scottie Scheffler is the best player in this tournament, but that Rory and Hovland are the next two. And they think that Straka and McIntyre are the two worst players in the tournament, but that Justin Rose and Brian Harman are effectively equal. So, Craig, as you're thinking about matchups, or at least just stacking these two teams up against each other, putting aside pairings and playing order and things like that, I'm having a lot of trouble figuring out what this European team is. You got Ludvig Åberg, who for all the world could be, you know, one of the best players on the planet, but it's just such a small sample. You got Rory, who's obviously phenomenal, but hasn't made a putt that mattered in 2 years. Like, how are you thinking about the quality of this team versus the US team, which is really inexperienced compared to a lot of the prior Ryder Cup teams the US has put out?
Yeah, I think the teams are pretty well matched. If you look at where they are as far as overall youth and leadership and kind of experience in the Ryder Cup, they're not that far off as far as, I mean, the US has a little bit of an advantage in the Ryder Cup experience. They've got I think the US has a little bit of an advantage in the overall rankings right now, if you were going to ask me. But I don't think any of it's that far off where it's overwhelming. I just think right now the Europeans actually have a little bit of the hotter hand as far as the players. I think Victor right now is such a determining factor in so many ways that I wouldn't bet against them in any way, shape, or form. You know, I don't know. I think it's a really evenly matched field, more than ever before. So it's What's the betting line across all of it? I mean, is it?
It's Europe minus 105, US plus 110.
Yeah, so I mean,
Europe very slightly favored.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be so close. I think it's really going to come down to the Sunday individual matches, and I bet it comes down to probably the last four matches of Sunday. If I was going to really put money on it, I think it's going to – I don't think anyone's going to run away with it. I think it's going to be back and forth, and I think it's going to come to the last four matches on Sunday to really determine who walks away with this thing. And I think the U.S. will pull it out. And it'll be, you know, it'll be a slight win, but not a blowout by any means.
Yeah, it's kind of weird to look at this. You know, 2008, remember Paul Azinger came up with this great idea of pods grouping.
Yeah.
Players, they're interchangeable based on certain playing characteristics and personalities that could get along. And there was, you know, you had a wide expanse of talent and personalities on that team. So he really had to work at it. I think Zach Johnson could literally just circle any four players in Europod, and they're kind of all the same. Like, you look at them, like, there's no real, except for like Kepka, you know, there's no one's like just a bomber like Rory. There's no one like, you know, as a putter and has a short game of Phil. It's just kind of like everybody's almost of the same talent level.
Yeah.
Like the C flight at the club championship, everybody's kind of the same. So it's going to be interesting. And you know, the personalities and skill level on the European team vary much more than the U.S. team. I think, you know, Luke Donald's going to have a harder time coming up with his pairings and be interesting to see what he does there. But yeah, it's just, this is a weird, I don't know if it's the live effect. The captains are so laid back. The players haven't said anything about each other. I think they were going into a sleepy Friday, and hopefully there's fireworks on Friday morning.
Well, I think it's a lot like we talked about with football too, where they almost have to create a persona, right? Like, are they going to portray themselves? And I think the Barstool guys actually talked about this a little bit too, where you almost have to portray yourselves as like the bad guys or the good guys or the whatever that is to kind of put a little target on your back, kind of like what Deion Sanders has been doing. And I know that backfired against him this weekend in Oregon, but you have to do something to bring yourselves together as a team, so you're not playing like a bunch of individuals. So how do you unify yourself against the, you know, the Europeans right now, where they have the home turf, they're going to have the crowd, they're going to have all these things going against them. Great. So let's call ourselves the bad guys. We're going into enemy territory. We're going to be up against it. Let's look at ourselves as it's us versus the world. Right. And if you do that, that gives them the edge where it's every shot they take, it's, man, I'm going to show these guys that, you know, I can make this putt. I can drive it 300 yards. I can do whatever. I think that's the one thing that's going to give these guys the edge. Because I don't think playing wise, I don't think there's really much out there that there's that much of a difference. And to be honest, I think the one guy that can play with Hovland right now is probably Brooks. If you put him head to head right now, as far as a little bit of ego and a little bit of chutzpah, I think Brooks is the one guy. If you said, all right, I'll go head to head with Hovland and not back down from him, I don't know if he'd win, but I think he'd love to take on that challenge and, you know, not back down from it at all. So I don't know.
Brooks beat Hovland head to head at the PGA. So he's already got that. And you know, that would be a great pairing when you got that choice. If Zach Johnson had the choice to pair if he chooses second, so he's pairing somebody against Hovland, Brooks is the one to put in there. Brooks is also the only one with like a chip on his shoulder going to this, is the only live player. But you know, you look at this, who's going to be the Paul Azinger? Who's the Lanny Watkins? Who's the Corey Pavin? Who's that fiery guy that gets under the skin and just gets in the face of all the fans, the European fans on their home turf? Someone's got to step up, and I just look at this team, and Koepka, I think, is the only one with the balls to do it.
Yeah. You don't think JT?
I think JT can and will if his game's on. If he's not playing well, that's, you know, you got to back it up with good play. Mm-hmm. JT was coming in here hot. If it was last year, if this Ryder Cup was last year, I was like, JT's the guy. You know, he's out there. at Whistling Straits, you know, in the afternoon, I think it was on Saturday, you know, ripping beers and chugging them and spiking them because he wasn't playing, getting the crowd fired up. It was awesome. And he was that fiery guy. But I think he's coming in with a little bit of tail between his legs. And so hopefully that, you know, he gets that tail wagging and gets in the face of people because he can do it.
He's such an emotional guy. If he comes out hot, maybe that's all he needs for, you know, a good 4-day run. But yeah. You're right, though. If he comes out slow, mm-hmm. God, he's going to be so defensive all week just to make sure that he's not the reason they lose. That's going to suck.
Yeah. I think the first group out has to be Spieth and Thomas paired together. They're the fire of this team. Get them out there on the course first. Hopefully they get the red color up there first, leading the match, and it gets back to all the other players. But you're going to need two fiery guys to go out and set the tone. Otherwise, these guys, I mean, Cantlay barely speaks. Is he going to get
the first? Cantlay barely speaks. Xander barely speaks. Yeah. It's the quietest team in Ryder Cup history.
I don't see any Seve Ballesteros is jingling their coins in their pocket and ripping their glove Velcro as someone's swinging. I don't see anyone on either roster doing that. But, yeah, we need the first one just be like, you know, JT and Spieth against, what do you think, Rory and Rahm? I mean, just let's get
you think they come right out with it like that?
I think you're going to have to come out fast on this one. Like I said, I think you need to set the pace early because I think someone's got to get momentum. That's what happens in a Ryder Cup usually, except for, you know, if you go back to some of the great comebacks by the Europeans, I think in 2012 and the US in
99. Yeah.
It tends to be a momentum event. You know, even looking at the Solheim Cup last week, the US went out and went 4-0 in the morning, and then all of a sudden it was, what, 5-3 after the afternoon, and then they end up blowing it. So the other team gets momentum, but I think you got to come out fast. You got to come out hard. You got to come out with fire. You got to get in their faces. You got to be a little bit irritating and turn the crowd on and turn the players on.
Talk me out of Xander.
Right, they should have brought Reed back just to caddy.
The team mascot.
Yeah.
Yeah, he could have been like an assistant captain, gone around the cart, just fired everybody up.
Getting the earpiece.
No team.
Talk me out of Xander and Cantlay being the best pairing in this entire Ryder Cup.
That's a solid. There's a couple of good ones. That's really solid. You could put Scotty Scheffler with anybody. I'd like to see a Morikawa and Homa pairing.
Oh man.
That would,
you know,
that,
all, I like that.
They don't all have to be emotional, right? They can be a silent killer for sure. Like,
yeah.
And I'll tell you what, Homa would definitely be emotional if,
oh yeah. If he steps up,
right group, like he's not far off from JT. I think if he's playing well and it's, you know, he's sinking big putts and hitting big chip shots, whatever, like he's going to show that emotion out there. There's no doubt. So I think in the right situation, Homo could be a huge factor for this. And I think he's really going to thrive in this environment if he's playing well. I think like anybody, if you start to fall apart, he's going to struggle, but you could say that for anybody, but you know, he does wear his emotion on his sleeve.
Yeah. I'm Zach. Jonathan, I'm coming out with Spieth and Thomas and Harmon and Koepka. Those are my first two groups.
Harmon and Koepka is like the most sicko thing I have ever heard. that is an absurd group.
Harmon's a fiery little dude, and Koepka's a fiery big dude.
That's incredible. Oh man, I hadn't even thought of who Brian Harmon would play with. I thought maybe they'd just stash him away until singles.
That dude is so fiery.
He is.
He plays with emotion, and there's an event like most golfers, you know, have to play sort of flatline to play well.
Patrick Cantlay style.
Yeah, exactly. Harmon isn't that way. He's like Tiger was up and down. Tiger liked to play fiery. You know, Thomas likes to play fiery. Spieth likes to play fiery. But a lot of these other guys don't. Get the fiery guys out there. Harmon, Koepka, Spieth, and Thomas. There's your first four.
I love it. So I think we should talk golf course. And Glenn, I think I'll mostly be deferring to you here. I feel like golf course and course setup get talked about a ton in anticipation of every Ryder Cup. And the Europeans have been pretty open about their use of data and, you know, team construction to give themselves the biggest advantage when they're playing on their home soil and basically build a tournament that it's really hard for the U.S. to win. And I don't know how much of that is looking back after the fact and going, hey, we crushed those guys. We must have done everything right. And how much of it is them actually knowing something extra and getting an advantage and having a really good system put together. I feel like I'm hearing a lot about how this course is different from Le Golf National, which is good because the U.S. was terrible there, but also about how this golf course is not like anything they play on the PGA Tour. I think it was Dan Rappaport was saying, like, think of the courses in Spain and Italy and Portugal that they play just every day on the European Tour. This is that style of golf course. How should we be reading into who the course is giving an advantage to, if the course is playing into anyone's hands, or is this just one of those overblown storylines that because the location changes every year, people make a big deal about it?
Yeah, I think it's just, I think it's another thing to talk about. You have to go back to Paris, right? And that course was short and quirky. They pinched the fairways. The greens were small, it took away a lot of drivers out of the hands of the U.S. players. And that used to be the thinking, like the U.S. players used to be much longer than the Europeans, but the Europeans have caught up. I think that this, from what I've heard, you know, Victor Hovland hates this course. They didn't like it. I think it's another quirky, sounds like a lot of dog legs. And I think that's sort of their modus operandi now after Paris. Like, yes, let's just do some quirky golf courses. But, you know, it's hard to find. You know, I played a bit in Europe. And once you get outside of the links courses and some of the great inland courses in you know, Great Britain and Ireland, the courses in Spain and France I found to be really quirky. You know, they tend to be huge elevation changes, lots of dog legs, lots of blind shots. It sounds almost like that there's a little bit of that here. You know, so it'll be interesting. I think it's, you know, it's always like sort of the losing team goes, why did we lose? Oh, because that course stunk. And, you know, they said we didn't like it. So it's, I think the course is more of an excuse rather than a predictor.
Craig, as you're thinking about what has to go right for the U.S. to win this Ryder Cup, obviously, we've talked about course setup. We've talked about team structure. We've talked about pairings. But every year for 30 years, something has held, or every fourth year for 30 years, I guess, something has held the U.S. back from winning this tournament in Europe. If that streak ends this weekend, it ended because what?
I think the U.S. has a really hard time winning if they come out slow. If they get behind by a lot in day one, I think it becomes really hard to come back and win this thing, because there's so much that starts to creep in at that point, as far as legacy, as far as the crowd, as far as, you know, man, they're just up against it. Are they the right group? The, you know, all that stuff. It just becomes harder and harder and harder to do it, right? If that's not saying it's insurmountable, but it becomes that much harder to do in a really tough situation regardless. So I think if they come out slow, it's going to be really hard to climb out of that hole. If they come out winning, or at least tying day one, I think they got a really good shot of winning this thing, because I think the Europeans are going to be relying on coming out guns blazing and using that crowd and the kind of shock factor of we are the crowd favorites. We are at, you know, our home turf, and we know this place better than anybody, blah, 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 even though they really don't, to their advantage. If that gets taken away, they're kind of in, you know, level playing field at that point. So I think that's the one deterrent. If they can hold their own day one, I think they got a good shot as anybody to win this thing.
Glenn, if the end of this weekend comes and the U.S. has lost the Ryder Cup, they lost because what happened?
They lost because Europe's top three beat our top three. They had a better record. McIlroy, Hovland, Rahm outplay Scheffler, Cantlay, and Schauffele.
Adds up. All right. We're not getting out of here without making predictions. Craig, I think you alluded to yours earlier, so I know you have it in the chamber. Let's hear it. Who wins? What's the score?
I think US
it's out of 28.
What's that?
It's out of 28.
No, I think
just
US
want to save you there.
No. I think the US wins. And I think they win. I think they win by a point and a half. So it comes down to the last day. It comes down to the singles matches, and I think they win by a point and a half.
I regret to inform you. Can you win by a point and a half?
Sorry. Well, 2 points. 2 points. Sorry.
All good. Okay. US by 2 points, which would be, as we've covered, their first victory in Europe since 1993, and it would be the same margin by which they won in 1993. Glenn, let's go to you. Who wins? What's the score?
It's tight because these teams are so evenly matched. I'm going to say it's a one-pointer. It's 14 and a half to 13 and a half. Is my math good there?
That math does not check out.
No?
Yes, it does. Yeah. That's 28.
Yeah, 14 and a half.
No, we're not supposed to be quizzed on this podcast.
There's another math test.
Yeah. So you guys both have the U.S. winning.
Yes.
Yeah.
I said a couple weeks ago, and I don't know that I can move off of it, that I haven't seen the U.S. win a Ryder Cup in Europe in my lifetime. And I don't know that I'm going to believe that it can happen before it does. But I'm going to take the back door out here. 14-14, U.S. retains the cup, but do not win outright in Europe. Because I feel like there's some devil magic going on. I don't know if it's even possible.
You know, I hope you're right, Will, because you had a 14-14 at the Solheim, followed by a 14-14 at the Ryder Cup. Hopefully that's the end of this ridiculous ends in a tie. Can't end in a tie.
Yeah, you got
the President's Cup, take one player from each team and go play head-to-head like Tiger and Ernie Els did years ago at the President's Cup.
Look, that would be a fine system, but Glenn, what you're discounting is this tournament is played against all the countries that love soccer. And all the soccer countries tolerate ties. They're wrong about it, but they're like, yeah, ties happen all the time. And then they have ridiculous standards for how they determine who won, like an overarching thing when there are ties, like goal differential. Like imagine if there was a tie and then the tiebreaker was like feet of putts made. Like it's insane. But yeah, we're never getting rid of the tie system, I don't think. But all since right, it's here.
I'm changing my prediction. U.S. nil, Europe nil.
Exactly, a nil-nil draw.
Nil draw. All matches end in a tie.
Yep.
No half points awarded for a tie. Nil-nil.
Nil-nil draw.
Even all right. I read an article about the Solheim Cup saying how happy both teams were to end in a tie.
I don't believe that.
There's no way anybody was happy, except for the European team maybe because they got to retain the cup. But like, there's no way that anybody's happy ever ending on a tie. It's ridiculous. It's just the worst. It's the worst thing in the world. I mean,
that President's Cup in South Africa, I think Jack Nicklaus is a captain of the United States team. Gary Player was the rest of the world minus Europe. They went out, Tigers player and Ernie goes too many holes. It's getting dark. You know, Gary's his usual magnanimous self. Oh, it should be a tie. Jack's like, yes, it's a tie. Yes, this is great for golf, Gary Player. And all of a sudden he's like, wait, they get to retain the cup? No, it's a tie. No, you actually lost. And then he was mad.
They should take the two captains give them both a putter and say the first one that actually gets to leave the putter green alive wins.
So there's a fight to the death in the event of a tie. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
American Gladiator style.
That might influence who you can convince to become a Ryder Cup captain. Like, I don't know if Zach Johnson has a death wish. I can't comment on it in either direction, but I don't know how common it is to have such a desire.
It's got to start somewhere, and it should start with this podcast.
You're on it. I think this is good.
So you will be the Ryder Cup captain who does the fight to the death against, like, Padraig Harrington or Henrik Stenson or whoever it might be.
Count me in.
All right. Okay.
Count me
noted. In. This is forever on the internet. So we all have the U.S. bringing back the Ryder Cup. I'll make sure not to use the word winning.
Yeah.
Craig, is it time to talk college football? We might have to talk college football.
Yeah. Before we get into your Notre Dame debacle, I have to give you a ton of props. I was not wrong, but you were not wrong either. I got to admit, I heard a couple things going on with Colorado. Colorado has put this badge of it is us against the world on there, and I know why they're doing it. And you said, hey, are they putting this target on themselves where it's every team in the country now is going to be gunning for them, looking to hurt these guys and whatever, whatever, whatever. And my response was, yeah, they are, but they're probably doing that to kind of protect themselves against all their deficiencies and all their holes they have, which they definitely are. But man, that come back and fight them in the butt against Oregon, because Oregon came out like a bat out of hell and beat the crap out of these kids. What we also found out was, and I don't know if this is true or not, but I heard this on a sports broadcast. A lot of other assistant coaches are calling teams that are playing Colorado in preparation for them, saying, we are so sick of these guys talking trash and acting like they are the kings of the world. Here's what you need to do to prep for them. Watch out for this.
Wow.
Like, coaches that never talk are now like aligning against them because they're just so sick of whatever. They have definitely put that target on their back. Now, also with that being said, Deion is already getting these 5-star recruits looking into next year coming to Colorado that never would have sniffed Colorado. So he is starting to build this empire of they will be a force to be reckoned with for years and years to come. So love him or hate what he's doing, it is working, and it will continue to work going forward because he is such a dynamic coach and such a dynamic figure. He will get better as a coach, and he will build his staff out. I know, like, Warren Sapp's looking to come on board and work with that D-line and whatever, whatever, whatever. So I don't think what he's doing is wrong by any means. I think, you know, neither side is wrong. But at some point, the trash talk, I think, needs to stop from the players. He can do whatever he wants to get his team riled up. And who am I to talk about how Deion needs to get his team prepared? I don't know anything about anything. I'm a youth football coach. And I do the same thing to a certain degree with the kids as far as getting them prepped and getting them excited about playing. And it's us against the world. And you do that every time you play anybody, you do that. But I do think he needs to have his kids tone it down a bit. Going up on the field and you know, scraping up against the Oregon symbol before.
Hey, look at my watch.
Yeah. Doing all that stuff like ahead of time. That crap's got to stop. That's literally going to get someone on their team hurt because they're looking to start World War III every time. But whatever. I get what he's doing. But I give you credit for calling that out, saying, man, these teams are gunning for him more than any other rivalry that's out there right now. They are creating a rivalry like no other against every team they play. And it's true. And it's absolutely.
And did you hear Oregon's coach, Dan Lanning, before the game? He was saying, we play for wins. They play for clicks. Like, yeah. Let's go show. Like, It's just good teams worry about giving bad teams bulletin board material, giving them a reason to think they can win or whatever. Bad teams or mediocre teams, which is probably what Colorado turns out to be, don't need to be giving good teams bulletin board material. Like Oregon, they put up, what, 42 points? They could have named their score on Saturday. If they wanted to put up 70, they could have.
Yeah.
And like, Colorado is not doing itself any favors by giving the Oregons and USC's and Utah's and Washington's of the world that kind of ammo. And I think I said it last week, like, we need to reshift, like, recenter the perspective on Colorado and acknowledge that this team winning 7 or 8 games would be a massive accomplishment compared to where they were. But like, if stuff like this keeps happening, that's going to become the narrative more than, holy cow, what Deion has done to rebuild and resurrect this program is really the story here. And like, they might surprise someone down the road. The Pac-12 is tough this year. There are going to be teams that come in tired and aren't prepared to deal with those athletes or whatever. But like, I think they would have played a more competitive game with Oregon if there hadn't been all this outside stuff to give Oregon a reason to care about beating the crap out of them.
Yeah, I just feel like they're not equipped enough right now to lose a kid like Hunter.
No, absolutely.
They have 4 or 5 star players. If one of them goes out, they quickly are falling apart. Not that I'm saying that they don't have other good players, but they're really relying on these top players to carry them. They'll get better. Look, next year he'll have even more star players and whatever. He's that much of a superstar personality, and I think he's getting better every year at coaching, where there'll be a force to be reckoned with for a long, long time. I just think, to a certain degree, don't take that bravado overboard.
Yeah.
To the point where the kids are going to be targeted and someone's going to get hurt with a cheap shot, or a fight's going to break out at halftime. Like, we don't need that crap. Like, at that point, it's going to be too far.
But did you see the video that Oregon put out this week? It was sort of like the little 5-minute recap of the game, but showing, like, you know, Deion's kid going up to them, going, "Why are you all so little? Why are you all so little?"
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And other players just looking at them warming up and just laughing, and they got punched right in the mouth.
Yeah. It's a bad precedent to start, right? Like, you just, I don't know. You used to want everyone to start to lose focus on the big picture of, like, hey, this is still college football, you know. But, you know, for whatever it's worth, it's working, because he also, again, like I said, he's bringing in a bunch of new 5-star recruits this week that were probably never would have sniffed Colorado
if he wasn't
there. So,
yeah, Colorado has to make sure they don't become Texas A&M, where they bring in the best recruiting class of all time and go 5-7. And I do think that's a concern, because like, Sean Lewis, their offensive coordinator, who was the head coach at Penn State, has already coached his way into a Power 5 coaching job this coming year. So like, turnover on that staff, if Deion keeps this program as visible as it is right now, is going to be a concern, and replacing those guys effectively every year is going to matter. But as I'm sure we're going to discuss shortly, talent in college football is the best thing you can have, and Deion is bringing it in to that school at a rate that it never would have seen before. So
yeah, and I think the revenue, I saw a number,
yeah,
I don't know if it's back or not, it's $100 million. The football program has brought in $100 million more in revenue than it's had last year. it's ticket sales are quadrupled what they were last year. Like, these numbers are astronomical. And again, yeah, I don't know if it's accurate or not, but it's, if these things are even close to being true,
feels true.
You know, it's crazy, crazy numbers. So,
they sell $4 million worth of sunglasses that Deion was wearing.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's his brand. Yeah. So he's making money hand over fist. It's a win-win for everybody.
Insane. Glenn, when Rutgers scored on that quick strike in the Big House, I sent a text to many of my friends who were in the tailgate lots at Notre Dame Stadium, and I said, hey, Michigan's on upset alert. Rutgers already has the lead. I got a lot of stop the count texts in response. Kind of wish they would have. Any reactions to the performance of the Scarlet Knights in Ann Arbor?
It was a typical Scarlet Knights big game performance where they keep our hopes up through the first half.
They looked frisky.
And then they're driving, and then they throw a pick six, and then the game's over.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, it's just a typical. There are a couple years, more years of Greg Schiano as head coach, hopefully keeping some of the talent around the Northeast at that school away from being competitive. But, you know, 3-1, we'll get to 4-1 playing Wagner this week, which is kind of a joke. So what do we need, like two more wins after that to get into a bowl game?
Yep.
So I think that's probably their goal this year, and hopefully, you know, play some of these games. Like, you know, they put up a fight against Michigan. I didn't get to see the whole game, only a little bit here and there. But yeah, they put up a fight, and you know, I don't believe in moral victories, but you know, at least you proved, you know, you weren't totally blown out. You weren't the Denver Broncos.
Oh man. Oh man. That was something. Craig, should we talk about it?
I think you have to. I mean, look, there's nothing else to talk about Michigan. There's nothing else to talk about Colorado. Let's just talk simple math. I mean, and now look, I coach 10 and 11 year olds, right? We do sprinkle in a couple 12 year olds. There was one series at the beginning of the game where I did have 11 players on the field. I had to call a timeout and we did a quick head count and I got the kid on the field just in time before the snap count. You guys had two plays in a very critical situation where if you were the defensive coordinator sitting in the booth looking down, it looked like the Chrysler Building. There was a whole side of a Chrysler Building on the right side of that defense where there was nobody. And they just... Yeah. Didn't think to say, hey, we should call a timeout.
They didn't have a timeout, I don't think. They had to, they would have had to either take a penalty or play with the 10 guys.
I don't know. It was big, big mistake.
Yeah, it was terrible. There's no other way to
be honest. I think I really do think Notre Dame outplayed them most of the game. I think. If they hold them there, which they definitely would have, I think Notre Dame's got a really good shot to win that thing in overtime.
They would have won it in regulation.
Yeah. Well, I think that drive was really the only drive that Ohio State was showing like a real sign of life more than anything else. So I think I don't know. I was feeling for you guys.
Mm-hmm.
And it was painful. It looked funny when I saw the replay, but you didn't see the full screen. So I didn't know it was only 10 people, to be honest with you, until after the game was over. And then all of a sudden it was all over social media and the news and everything else. But I don't know. Did Notre Dame coaches even address it after the fact?
Yeah. So they talked about it a couple times. They said, right after the game, it was like, we didn't want to take the penalty because we didn't want to give them another chance to like reset. And they had thrown on the down before, which was interesting. And then they were asked about it again. Freeman was asked about it in his Monday press conference. And he basically said, like, you know, that can't happen. It comes down to me. We noticed it too late. We didn't want to, you know, run another guy on, take the penalty or whatever. It sucks, man. Like, that's what a terrible way to lose a football game. And obviously, like, you don't know that if you have the 11th guy out there, you definitely stop Trainum or Williams or whichever running back it was for Ohio State who scored. But you, Craig, being a Michigan fan, may not understand this, but I think being a Michigan fan from like 1998 to 2020, you'll understand it. Notre Dame had not been the better team in a game against a team of Ohio State's caliber with Ohio State's talent, with the talent gap that existed between those two teams in 30 years. Like, not since they beat the Charlie Ward Florida State team had Notre Dame been the better team in a game like this. And that's where you get Notre Dame always gets blown out in big games. And that's where you get Notre Dame hasn't won a BCS game since whenever. And that's where you get all of those things. Even when they lost to 2015 Clemson, who went to the national championship by two on the road, even when they lost 2-1 possession games to Georgia teams that played in the national championship, they didn't lead in those games. They needed miraculous things to go right for them to be that close in those games. In this game, look at all the ways they had to shoot themselves in the foot to lose, from calling play action on a fourth and short and then getting their fourth down conversion overturned on their first offensive drive, to not converting a QB sneak in the second half, to putting 10 guys on the field for the last two plays of the game, to allowing a third and 18 conversion a couple plays before that. Like, for me, watching this, seeing a game in which Notre Dame, what did they play? A C-plus game? Their defense played pretty well for the majority of the game, but they really didn't move the ball on offense very much. Like, and they made all these mistakes. That's probably like a C-plus game. For Notre Dame to play a C-plus game,
they probably shut down the number one receiver in the league and the all of college.
Yeah, because they have the best cornerback in all of college.
But that's one of the hardest things to do.
Yeah.
And you did that.
Yeah, so it's incredible. Like, there is so much that they did well. There's a lot of stuff they did poorly. For Notre Dame to do that much wrong in a game against a team of this caliber and still be one boneheaded play away from winning the game is immense progress compared to where this team has been. Like, the Brian Kelly teams never lost, at least after 2016, they never lost games they were supposed to win, but they also never won games they were supposed to lose, with the exception of maybe 2020 Clemson, but it was against the backup quarterback. There's a lot to litigate there. This Marcus Freeman team, by playing that game, I think showed that they are capable of winning a game they're supposed to lose. They didn't do it, but they didn't do it for self-inflicted reasons. And to me, like, if we're talking about program building and things like that, it suggests to me that what Marcus Freeman is building here is actually taking the next step over where Brian Kelly was. I said to my friends, there are things that could have happened on Saturday that would have made me believe that it's impossible for this team to beat USC, because they're not going to be able to contain Caleb Williams and contain those receivers, because they're not going to be able to score on that defense no matter how porous it is. Whatever it is, I would argue that coming out of that game, Notre Dame should be favored against USC. Like, I think a lot of really good stuff happened. And I said in 2019 after the Georgia game, I hate that Notre Dame keeps getting credit for playing good teams close. And obviously, like, no moral victories. It's a loss. It's a loss that is basically inexcusable in the way that it happened. But it is such a change for Notre Dame to have been the better team in that game. And it's not something we were ever able to say before. So it's one loss. They have opportunities to get a number of big wins the rest of the way. I believe this team should go 11-1 based on that performance. And look, it sucks. It stings. They should have won that game. It would have been the biggest win, Notre Dame win of my lifetime. And I'm pissed that it didn't happen. But when it comes to what it means for the program, I think there's a lot of good to take out of it.
I thought your quarterback did not play a great first half. I think if he played a much better second half. I was ready to pile on him and, you know, just taking mental notes as I was watching the game, getting ready for the podcast. And then all of a sudden he played much better in the second half.
The back-to-back touchdown drives after they went down 10-0 was really, really impressive.
Yeah. And I think all around as a team, It sucks to see Notre Dame drop to 11 and Ohio State be at 4. Yeah. You're like, it just, you're so close together. Yeah. That game could have gone either way, the, you know, flip of a coin. You know, I guess it's just there's that many undefeated teams still out there because there's so many bloated schedules right now. But
yeah,
but that'll change throughout. You know, they just got to hold their own. But I agree with you. I think Notre Dame will still be in the mix come the end of the season. They just got to – they just – unfortunately, that's when they had to win only because now you can't make another mistake.
Yeah.
You can't end up with two losses.
No.
And end up in the playoff race most likely. So you can still end up with a great bowl game and everything else, but you can't end up with you know, two losses in the playoff. No. So, but I agree with you. I was ready to pile on you. It sucked to be such a stupid mistake.
Yeah.
Because it was a game of inches, and if you had that player there, that guy doesn't get in. End of story. You guys win the game. But
pretty cool. Should we wrap up with some NFL?
Yeah. Look, Giants suck. We've had more missed tackles this year than we've had all of last year, which is a crazy, crazy thing to think through. You got Miami, which is putting on an absolute clinic. If you talk to me about how good Miami was going to be at this point in the season, and I know they you know, haven't played all great teams so far, I never would have thought they would have been this much of a powerhouse. You know, their defense still is somewhat skeptical, but they are much better than I thought. It's such a wishy-washy league right now. I don't know if there's anybody that's absolutely pulling ahead except for you got the Masters in the league right now with Miami, the Niners and Philly.
Yeah.
Bills, I think maybe close behind if they can figure out some of their stupid mistakes. But other than that, it's like, I think it's really up for grabs with another 7 or 8 teams that are right behind them, which is great to me. I think I don't think you want, you know, a ton of teams running away with their divisions at this point. You want a bunch of teams trying to figure, you know, crap out before you know, this early in the year.
Did you get a good chuckle out of the Cowboys performance this weekend, at least?
It was the best. It was absolutely the best. I texted every Dallas fan I know about how great their team is as soon as that game ended. I was tempted to start texting those at halftime, but I ahead of myself. But that was my favorite game of the Sunday by far.
Makes sense. Glenn,
yeah.
What do we make of this Bills team? It's been unusual.
It's been unusual. We had a shaky start. The Jets, it was a quirky game from the beginning. Bad punt return finish. Totally destroyed the Raiders. Josh Allen played a perfect game. Look, we blew out the Commanders again, but the defense had 9 sacks and 5 turnovers, and they scored a touchdown. So. The defense is just overwhelming. Josh, you know, scored 30 points and the offense scored 30 points, you know, more than enough, of course, to win. I think we're going to find out Sunday when they play the Dolphins. And I think the NFL is mad that, you know, the first eligible week for flex is next week. So they're going to pick one a Sunday night. Because I think everybody wants to see this one. I think everyone's jumping the gun. Look, the Miami offense was a machine on Sunday. But it was against a bad team. And, you know, they squeaked by the Chargers. The Chargers probably should have won that game. Again, they blew a late lead. The Pats played them tough. So I'll be curious, as I am every week with the Bills. I think the Bills are going to give them a game. I can't wait to watch.
I really appreciated the Bills for – if I can't have my narrative that Brock Purdy is the same guy he was in college – I at least can have the narrative that Sam Howell is the same guy he was in college. I will go to the ends of the earth to show that guys from random schools that get way too much football hype, like Iowa State and UNC have in recent years, are actually nothing special. And the Bills went a long way towards showing that Sam Howell may indeed be nothing special. So I thank them for that. Craig, as we get things wrapped up here.
Wait, but by the way, it was great to see Josh Allen, with all the crazy throws he made last week that he completed, and everyone's like, oh, he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. When he makes those same throws and they're not completions and interceptions, they're like, oh, he's lost it. He's
a terrible decision maker.
Yeah, he's horrible. He's you know, this is why the Bills are falling off the face of the earth, blah, blah, blah. It's just, this is what makes Josh Allen Josh Allen, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he just stopped. Mm-hmm. He's throwing off one leg, doing a split. Yep. You know, just everyone just relax.
Can't stop him.
Yeah.
You let him be himself.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Sorry, Will.
All good. Craig, you want to get us ready for Morris County?
Yeah. Again, last event next Tuesday, October 3rd, Morris County Golf Club in Morris County, New Jersey. It is a 1 o'clock shotgun. So 11:30 registration and lunch. Go to oneclubshort.com and register. We hope to see you all there. We got a couple foursomes left. Not many. But it's a better ball of the foursome, net and gross winners. Ton of prizes, tea gifts, lunch, golf, and cocktails. So we'd love to see you all there. It's going to be a great day. The weather looks awesome. I think it's going to be 75 degrees and sunny. Perfect fall ball. And looking forward to it. Come say hi.
Love it. So that's oneclubshort.com to get signed up there. Glenn, before we wrap up here, any parting shots from you? Still no arrests on the Rutgers football team, right?
No arrest on Rutgers, so that's good. We're loving it.
The streak continues.
Well, let's not get too ahead of ourselves. It's a long season. My prediction, Buffalo Bills 34, Miami Dolphins 31.
Wow. That would be the game of the season so far, I think.
It's going to be. Until the Bills play the Chiefs.
Okay. All right. Well, we hope everyone enjoys the Ryder Cup. As always, oneclubshort.com for everything you want to know regarding dates, courses, membership, registration. October 3rd, Morris County Golf Club. You can follow us on Instagram where we're at oneclubshort and Twitter where we're at oneclubshort and then the number one. Podcasts are available wherever you get your podcast with the added bonus of video on Spotify. And the videos also go up on YouTube where we are at One Club Short Pod. Guys, enjoyed it as always. We'll be back similar time, similar place next week to recap the Ryder Cup and the week that was in NFL and college football. And until then, let's go USA. And thanks everyone for listening.
See ya.